It is 8:32, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish with Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
No Maria this morning.
Well, let's see. This is the election issue of Eat the State is out now, and the headline is Tragedy or Farce, and it's definitely leaning toward farce this morning. Let's see. Maria missed her bus, so we didn't actually plan for her absence. She's just not here. And then
she tried to make it, and then the cab couldn't come for 20 minutes, so she wouldn't have gotten here until the last 5 minutes.
And then my laptop died this morning, so I don't have any of my notes.
It's going to be us making animal noises for the next 25 minutes.
Yeah, we're going to wing. We still have lots to talk about, mind you. But if it sounds a little less coherent than it usually does, it's because, well, for a change, we're not cheating this week.
No flashcards like Sarah Palin. We'll get to that later.
No, and the teleprompter doesn't work very well either.
All right. Well, with what we do got, let's start out with local and an update on Nicholsville.
Yeah, we talked last week about Nicholsville, the homeless encampment that was intended to be a permanent village, a permanent encampment and a place where the homeless could go that would be safe and also a visible reminder of Greg Nichols' policies toward the homeless in this city. Well, the city has pretty relentlessly been chasing it from place to place, and we talked last week about how they had moved to Daybreak Star, where they should have been legally protected from being chased around by the city because United Indians of All Tribes, which has a long-term, I believe 99-year lease for Daybreak Star from the city of Seattle, has as part of that lease that they can let anybody camp there that they want to. For whatever reason, the city was able to force the encampment off of that land. They had to move again yesterday. And now the sponsors in Nicholsville are saying, the last I heard anyway, I put a call into them last night to see if they had landed somewhere. They had said that they were planning to move, but they didn't know where they were going to go. And the city has at this point gotten an injunction saying that the sponsors in Nicholsville are enjoined from camping anywhere within King County, which is kind of unique because where exactly are the homeless supposed to go? Is this a legal ruling that says that the homeless cannot, in fact, sleep outdoors anywhere in King County? It's really kind of astonishing if it is, but probably it would. I mean, it can't be enforced that way, obviously. But this is once again a reminder of the deeply hostile and deeply inhumane policies of the Nichols administration toward the homeless, and that the supposed 10-year plan to end homelessness is not particularly a 10-year plan to actually provide solutions to the problems of people who lack the resources, either monetary or public health or otherwise, to be able to have stable housing. It's simply trying to sweep them out of sight.
I saw in this morning's paper, it looked like they've landed at the, I think it's University Christian Church on 47th and 15th.
Oh, have they? Okay.
In the parking, the big parking lot they have across the street?
Yeah, I didn't realize that because I'd actually gone over there yesterday and hadn't seen anything there, so I didn't want to say that.
They had a photo of the parking lot. You didn't see necessarily, tents in it yet, but that's what it sounded like.
Well, this is what I get from my computer crashing this morning, and I was so busy with that I didn't actually get a chance to open up the old-fashioned paper. But, that's good news then. That's very good to hear. But once again, it seems... I don't see how, if it's on private property, that the city can chase them off. But at that point, it simply becomes another tin city.
Mm-hmm.
And it's certainly not a permanent solution because that parking lot that the church leases at 47th and 15th, or rather 50th and 15th, is a fairly significant source of revenue for that church. So. I doubt they'd be willing to forego that permanently on behalf of Nicholsville. So, we'll see what happens with them.
Yeah. There's something also ironic about your mention of that the All Tribes have a 99-year lease on, land, city land, when really it was their land before.
Yeah,
the city
no. I thought of that while I was saying that, too.
All right.
It is Indian land, but in fact, it was, we'll steal the land from you and then lease it back to you. It's quite a deal.
All right. Did you want to then move on to the election?
Yeah, we as I mentioned, we put out the Eat the State election recommendations this week, and since Maria is, we're going to go ahead and start in on that, although the absentee ballots don't actually arrive until the middle of this coming week, so. So it's timely. We weren't going to start for another week, but since Maria's not here, what we thought we would do is go ahead and talk about the court races and the ballot initiatives where she's not as likely to feel a need to pitch in, whereas when we talk about things like the presidential race, I think Maria will want to be part of that discussion. Mm. So let's start with the court races, and this again is something that is on the Eat the State website at www.eatthestate.org. Not nearly as many competitive court races as there were in the primary ballot in August, for the simple reason that most of the two-way races there were decided where one justice got more than 50% of the vote. So there's really only a few races left. Most of them races where there were three potential judges that were vying for the position in August, and now it is down to two. And unfortunately, in most of those races, the most progressive of the would-be judges, the one that we endorsed, did not make it through to the final round. So let's see what we have left. First of all, we have the state Supreme Court and the local Court of Appeals Division I, District 1. In both of those cases, there are multiple incumbents running for re-election unopposed, and as we have traditionally said with elections both here and in the old Soviet Union, if there's only one name on the ballot, don't vote for it. However, there are some contested ones. In King County Superior Court, there's three of them, actually. Position number one, we have Tim Bradshaw and Suzanne Parisian. Suzanne Parisian is a former corporate lawyer for Nordstrom's versus Tim Bradshaw, who is the incumbent. We're going with the incumbent there, Tim Bradshaw. Superior Court position number 22, we had a three-way race in August with two progressives and a conservative. One of the progressives, the progressives split the vote in August, so we have the conservative, Julia Garrett, who is running against the surviving progressive, Holly Hill. The problem with Holly Hill is not how she would rule on the court. It is she has spent $70,000 of her own money to essentially buy a judgeship in a race where, because a lot of voters don't have much information on the judicial races, they depend on name recognition, and $70,000 buys a lot of yard signs and direct mail. So the basic precedent of using a lot of your own money in order to buy a judgeship is one that is troubling us very much. So even though Holly Hill would probably make a perfectly servable judge, we don't like the precedent that it sets. So we recommend that you not vote for either one of them in position number 22. And then in position number 37, we have once again the two surviving ones are the two more conservative ones. However, one of them, we have Jean Reichel, who is a former public defender against and the incumbent. We think she's better than the challenger, Barbara Mack, who is an ambitious deputy prosecuting attorney who has a lot of political endorsements, but clearly also is much more of a law and order judge than Jean Reichel. And frankly, we don't need more law and order judges in King County Superior Court. We need more people who can apply the law fairly and evenly. So those are the three judicial races that are contested. There are a number of different ballot initiatives on the ballot this time. Three statewide ones. I-985 is Tim Eymann's latest attempt to divert money out of the general fund and away from public transit and toward building more freeways. He's billing it as congestion relief, and it would do things. It would do a number of different things. It would build more lane capacity, or it would set money aside for that. It would, although probably unconstitutionally, since it takes it out of a dedicated fund. Also, it would synchronize lights and have a few other doodads that sound good, but a lot of transportation experts are saying it wouldn't actually relieve congestion, it would actually make it worse. And frankly, you can take professional transportation planners to solve our transportation problems, or you can trust Tim Iman. I know which one I would go with. So we're recommending no on 985, Tim Iman's latest really bad idea. We have I-1000, which is the Death with Dignity initiative, where religious lobbies, particularly the Catholic Church, are pouring in a lot of money, both in-state and out-of-state, to try and defeat a law that we modeled on. It's modeled on Oregon's assisted suicide law, which for the past 10 years has allowed the terminally ill to end their life at a time of their choosing, rather than essentially prolonging their agony. There are a lot of safeguards to it. It is a very similar issue to issues of reproductive choice and the old laws that used to be in place against sodomy and various other things, where the state is interfering with our control over our decisions of what we want to do with our own bodies. And we urge a very strong yes on I-1000, which would allow death with dignity. And then on I wrote in Eat the State, and I've written in some other places, that's something that I may need to take advantage of at some point myself, simply because of the fairly serious health problems that I have and that I've had in the past. It's something that I feel really very strongly about. And if people want to read my take on that, it is available online. So, yes on I-1000. And then I-1029, something that you haven't heard very much about, is a measure that would require certification with the state for long-term care workers for the elderly and disabled persons. This is something that has become necessary as more and more of the care for these individuals has moved out of hospitals and nursing homes and whatnot and into the private home. People who are helping those folks are not facing the same licensure requirements as professionals that work in healthcare facilities, and that's a loophole that there really is no opposition against closing. So yes on that. There are a number of charter amendments from King County, and I want to run through these fairly rapidly because, frankly, some of them are important and some of them are kind of arcane. Charter Amendment number 1 is one of the important ones. It would elect the county's elections director. This is something that we've talked about in past elections because there's been a couple of preliminary steps to get this on the ballot. It would elect a elections officer rather than having to be an appointed job right now. And this is something the county Republicans have been trying to get in place. They're still sore over Gregoire Rossi in 2004. They blame the King County Elections Office for their having lost the race by, 3 votes or whatever it was. And they want to make it a partisan elected office essentially to solve this by trying to get a Republican into that office. Frankly, an elections office is something that requires an impartial, professional, somebody who does elections for a living, somebody who actually knows the technology and knows the problems and knows how to manage them, as opposed to a political hack. We've seen in places like Ohio and Florida where the political hackery gets us. So a very strong no on that one. Charter Amendment number 2 is a very progressive one. It would add disability, sexual orientation, and gender identity or expression to the list of King County's banned discriminatory practices in employment and contracting. A very strong yes on that one. That, I think, would be one of the first places in the country that would add transgender and gender identity to things that you can't discriminate against. And it's a very welcome step. Charter Amendment number 3 would revise the structure of regional committees, most notably reducing the number of county council members from 6 to 3. Sure, why not? Number 4 would establish professional qualifications for the elected office of sheriff and assessor. That one we have problems with. It's another one of these that sounds good on the face of it, but no other county in the state has professional qualifications for any of its elected offices, including things like sheriff and assessor. And frankly, it's a solution in need of a problem. There hasn't been a problem with this, and we have a tradition in this country that anybody, if it's an elected office, anybody over if they're a registered voter and over a certain age and a citizen can be elected to that office, and I have a problem with interfering with that tradition. So no on that. Number five on the King County Charter Amendments establishes an economic forecast council and an office of economic and financial analysis for the county. There is already such institutions at the state level, but let's face it, the county's economy is a very different beast than the state of Washington's economy, and something that the county, given that it is one of the 15 or 20 most populous counties in the United States, really needs those kind of tools in order to plan for budgets and whatnot. So a strong yes for that one. Number six moves the budget deadline 20 days earlier so that council people and departments have more of a chance to look at it and more time for the rest of us to catch all the hidden surprises. Yes on that one. King County Charter Amendment number 7. This has one good provision, namely that it moves the county council approval process for citizen initiatives to make it to the ballot. In other words, you don't have to have the county council approve a voter initiative once it has the required number of signatures or offer an alternative to it. It just goes directly to the ballot. Unfortunately, it also has one really bad provision, which is that it doubles the number of signatures that are required to get it onto the ballot. And King County already has a threshold that by per capita is already 20% higher than its statewide equivalent. So this would double, it would make it twice as hard to get it on the ballot, basically. So no for that. And then finally, for the county charter amendments, number 8 would make the King County Executive, County Council, and County Assessor nonpartisan. We talked about this in August also, and this once again is a Republican stealth initiative, because what it would do is not make the offices nonpartisan. It would make the it would enable the people running for office to not disclose their partisan identities or affiliations. And we've already seen that, for example, with Dino Rossi saying he prefers the GOP rather than being a Republican to try and mask what it is that he believes in, because it's not very popular right now.
The GOP party.
Yes, the GOP party. So in addition to being deceptive, it's horrible grammar, and on that alone, he shouldn't be elected governor. But we'll talk about that next week. On a truth in advertising label, we say no to that one. And then there are a handful of other propositions, two for the city of Seattle. Number one is a Pike Place Market, $73 million in property taxes levy. And number two is a parks levy that would put in $145 million. And, we're all for Pike Place Market and for the parks, although we have concerns with the transparency and decision-making process of the Parks Department of Seattle, which has been very problematic over the last few years, especially with the commercialization under the Nichols administration. These are things that don't need to be done right now. And in bad economic times, and when taxpayers are facing bad economic times, it's not a good time to be doing tax hikes and taxing ourselves for something else. So we say no to both of these. When you manage your personal budget and times are hard, you cut back and you defer things and you delay. And we don't see any reason why local government should manage it differently. And then finally, there are some things that just can't wait. And Sound Transit proposition number one is one of them. This would be the expansion of light rail to the east side. And frankly, we know we're going to do it. We know we're going to need to do it. We know that the sooner that we get everybody, or at least a large number of people, out of their cars and into mass transit, the more effective it will be for the metropolitan area. So we know it needs to be done. The longer we wait, the more expensive it'll get and the worse traffic we'll get. So unlike Iman's 985, this actually would reduce would reduce congestion and be a good investment in our future. So yes, on proposition number one for Sound Transit. And those are the ballot initiatives. Once again, they are at www.eatthestate.org. And next week, we will talk about the elected offices.
All right. That moves us on then to this week's national news and the economy, briefly. Did you want to touch that one?
Normally, yeah, I did, actually. Although we took a little bit longer with the elections than I thought we would. And I know Maria had a great deal more that she wanted to say, so I didn't do a lot of preparation on this for this week. I did want to note that the G7 has been meeting over the past few days to try and hash out an international response to this, and that really underscores a core nature of this problem, which is that even compared to, say, 10 years ago when we had the Asian financial markets with all of their problems, the technology has changed so rapidly in terms of the globalization of international capital and how the global markets work, that we're really in uncharted waters here in terms of how the markets might be melted down. And at the same time, it really underscores how the regulatory regimes for this, both domestically and internationally, simply have not kept up with technology. And in fact, it's been exactly the wrong time to deregulate. That being said, I know Maria wanted to talk also at one point about how all of the doomsday media coverage of this, talking about, you know, global financial collapse and things like that, is really now overstating the severity of the issue, just as they were understating it for the past couple of years during the housing bubble and as the subprime mortgage crisis cascaded into the current situation that we have. So let's just touch on those points briefly and leave it to the expert to talk about it next week.
Okay, very good. Moving on. Sarah Palin this week, and some ethics charges.
Yes, the state of Alaska, in a commission that included 11 different Republicans, even though the McCain campaign is now trying to decry the whole exercise as a partisan witch hunt, it wasn't. Came out with a ruling yesterday in a classic Friday afternoon news dump that Sarah Palin, as governor of Alaska, abused her power, violated the law, and also illegally pressured a number of state employees underneath her to violate the law in trying to get a state trooper in Alaska fired for personal reasons. Now, in the annals of abuse of power, this is a relatively minor infraction. Nobody's saying this compares with, oh, say, you know, lying to get our nation into an unnecessary and illegal war, or you know, firing U.S. attorneys for political reasons or anything like that. But what it does demonstrate is that Sarah Palin, and this is something that we've seen pretty consistently throughout her brief and unremarkable political career, is petty. She is vindictive. She abuses her power for personal reasons, and she has very little contempt for the rule of law. And haven't we really seen this enough in a vice president? So this I think is probably one more nail in the coffin of the McCain Palin campaign. We have also seen there was the rather amusing, if repulsive, spectacle yesterday of John McCain slapping down his own followers when they started booing Barack Obama and saying that they were scared that he was an Arab and Arab and whatnot in a town meeting hall. This is sort of like setting a house on fire and then wanting credit because you show up at the scene of the arson with a bucket of water. McCain and Palin have really been playing with hate in terms of the sort of coded racial appeals and the incitements to hate that they've been trying to whip up in a lot of their followers in sort of their last ditch desperate attempt to make this a competitive race because they have so little traction on economic issues. You know, Ayers hasn't stuck. A lot of this stuff hasn't stuck. And they've really been, especially Palin, appealing to the worst in their followers. And it's really been very, very frightening to watch. And I think that's what should stick with voters, not McCain's supposedly honorable attempt to put out the fire that he himself helped start.
All right. And Connecticut.
Yeah, very good news, briefly, because we're running out of time here. A Supreme Court ruling in the state of Connecticut yesterday ruled that civil unions are unconstitutional for gay couples. Why are they unconstitutional? Because they don't allow gay marriages. In other words, civil unions themselves have been used by timid politicians as a way, as a sort of separate but equal clause, that you can have all of the rights of married couples, but governments will not allow you to actually be married because that's only for a man and a woman. And the Connecticut Supreme Court ruled that no, you have to allow gay marriage. It's an unappealable ruling, and so on October 28th, Connecticut will be the first state, or the third state rather, to allow gay marriage legally, and the first state to say that civil unions specifically are an unconstitutional substitute for that.
All right, and very briefly, Iraq.
Just a couple of things to flag in Iraq. The surge, once again, has still got all sorts of problems that we're not hearing about in U.S. media. A report from Patrick Coburn in The Independent yesterday that cholera is becoming widespread once again, and a new national intelligence estimate that came out this week that got very little media attention, especially in the when it came out immediately after John McCain's debate performance, saying once again that the surge has led to victory in Iraq. The NIE saying that Iraq isn't won yet, that there is still a lot of very significant challenges remaining there and a lot of things that can and are going wrong.
All right, and then that leaves us with events.
Several events these coming few days. Today at noon, there will be an anti-war rally as a part of a national day of action, trying to put the Iraq war on the radar screen for both of the political candidates once again. That will be at noon at Pratt Park at 20th and Yesler in the Central District, with a march afterwards. Tuesday night, Rick Steves will be appearing at Town Hall. Some local activist groups recently helped him go to Iran and do a PBS special, which will be coming up, I believe, in January, focusing on the people and places there in an effort to humanize the people of Iran and try to prevent a U.S. attack on Iran. Some disturbing reports this week saying that the U.S. Bush administration isn't going to launch an October surprise, but is trying to talk Israel into doing so. Anyway, he'll be showing his film from Iran and talking about his experience there. 7:30 at Town Hall. Tickets for that are $10 on next Tuesday. And then on Friday, there will be a benefit for the Backbone Campaign with the Seattle Labor Chorus, Jim Page, George Mann, Citizens Band, and Patriot Act. That will be a compilation CD release party also of songs of 8 years of resistance to George Bush. It's also $10 in advance, $12 at the door. 7:30 at Trinity United Methodist Church, 23rd and 65th in Ballard. That again on Friday evening this coming week.
All right. And then tomorrow, there's also the unembedded showing and lecture at 5 o'clock at Kane Hall. So
yes, the fine folks you heard at 7:30.
That's right. Talking as we do every week with Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State comes out every couple of weeks with news, opinion, and humor about the world around us, locally and internationally. It appears in print as a free newspaper wherever you find free periodicals, bookstores, cafes, the King County Library System, etc. Or you can find it on the web. And once again, our election endorsements in the new issue are there, as well as out on the street at www.eatthestate.org. If you have questions, comments, tips, feedback, feel free to email us. Info@eatthestate.org is the email address.
Very good.